Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. With us today, we have Greg Martin. Greg is the CEO and co-founder of Ghost Security. Greg, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. So let's start with Ghost Security. What problem is it solving in the marketplace?
Yeah, Ghost is a new company, about 3 years old. We are tackling making apps and software safer. Our approach is that we've built our own agentic model that essentially understands software application security and vulnerabilities like a human expert. And it continually runs over all new software releases that your developers make. And it looks for those tricky to find bugs and issues in the software that could lead to some risk to the business. So our product is a SaaS. We offer it to businesses. Our sweet spot is kind of medium to large enterprise. And we're able to really find and help remediate risk at a much faster and higher degree of quality than ever before, because we've kind of built this new agentic approach. And the underlying engine is just fundamentally better. The tech is better now. So that's what's exciting about Ghost.
So, you know, if I had to make a guess, the majority of our audience will be familiar with penetration or pen tests as an ability to do a risk assessment on a piece of software. How does Ghost Security, or how should our audience think of Ghost Security relative to a pen test?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in application security or cybersecurity in general, you're always trying to develop, like, what is my holistic strategy to reduce risk, because that's the job of any good security professional, is to reduce risk to the business. So when we're talking about protecting our apps, our software, it's a critical part of the business, because that's where a lot of the business is done. The revenue is made is through these applications, whether it's connecting with customers to fulfill an invoice or a CRM or some API that delivers some service to your customer base. So the apps are kind of the lifeblood of our business. In app security, there's traditionally been kind of three main approaches to security controls. One is the penetration test, because, you know, the talent that's required to do a very good penetration test is so limited in the market. Most organizations don't have the ability to have full-time talent onboarded. So they usually consult with an external third-party service to do a penetration test, typically once or twice a year, if they're lucky, maybe quarterly. But they take time and they're expensive, and the results can be mixed. Sometimes you get a really high-quality penetration test and high-quality findings and reduce some risk, and sometimes they just miss it entirely because, you know, humans make mistakes. So there's other security controls that are added to supplement that in more of a continuous fashion. So one is called SAST, which is static application security testing, where it looks at the source code. And another is called DAST, which is dynamic application security testing, where you're actually testing the running app itself, much like a pen tester would. And these are, SAST and DAST are two software technologies that have been around for over a decade. They're widely deployed in industry, and most organizations have one or both of those technologies deployed in addition to supplementing with penetration testing. Now, Ghost has innovated a new approach. And we're essentially taking SaaS and DAST and kind of melding it into one product. So we're creating an easier to use, better version of SaaS and DaaS in one technology. And the end result is better results. You're upgrading your technology, but you're also saving money by potentially eliminating an additional security control for one newer technology. So that's one of the other exciting things that customers love about Ghost is that they're consolidating their tools in the process.
So, for those of us who don't have the same level of familiarity with mitigating vulnerabilities in software, where do they normally originate? Is it in the source code behind the firewall, or is it usually the surface area that connects with the outside world?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, developers are really not security experts, right? The majority of them are, that's not their thing. They're writing software and creating new value and innovation to the business. So software vulnerabilities and bugs just happen. It's a natural part of the business. And the business always wants new innovation. So developers are furiously pumping out new code and apps and updates to everything that they do. And a lot of times, that creates new vulnerabilities, which really means that waiting a year or a quarter for a pen test to maybe find the risk that was introduced is too long. So when developers are pushing their code, whether it's an internal only app, which is maybe, a little bit less risk to the business because it's only internal users that are using that app, or a customer facing app that's deployed to the cloud, or is on mobile and it has access to the general public. Now that's where the real risk is going to be found, because then you can have, somebody doing that penetration test for you, from Eastern Europe. And, that's where some of the bad stuff starts to happen for these businesses. And, as the sophistication level grows for the bad guys, they've leveraged a lot of automation and tools and AI for themselves to find these vulnerable apps and automate the process, or at least a lot of the process of trying to exploit those vulnerabilities. And, the risk could be as little as them being able to kind of log in and maybe read some emails to being able to, actually get access to your customer information, or in some cases, the entire database of your customers. So whenever you log into a website and it says, hey, you need to change your password, this password has been found in a data leak, right? I think everybody's familiar with seeing that. And they're like, oh man, that's not fun. Well, those data leaks happen because of vulnerabilities in software and apps. So the bad guys then, take advantage of those vulnerabilities that the developers accidentally push out there in their app updates. And the bad guys will extract that database and then they'll kind of trade it and sell it internally, because, oftentimes that includes things like passwords, home addresses, phone numbers, email addresses of the customers. That's how it happens. And Ghost is trying to solve the problem at the source code before it gets pushed. That's really what we're doing.
You answer my next question, and that it was, I was going to ask is, where is the biggest value for Ghost security? Is it in UAT or production? But I think I heard it's during QA, before the push to production, and you can do an assessment to decide, hey, is this fit for prime time?
Yeah, exactly. And one of the cool things that AI allows us to do now is automatically generate the code fixes to solve or remediate the bugs and vulnerabilities. So that's something that Ghost does. That's a new innovation because some of these really stronger models are able to obviously start writing code for us. So we take full advantage of that. We still have a human in the loop. So the vulnerability is found, the code fix is made, and it's pushed to the developer. The developer then simply has to review that code fix and click a button to decide, do they want to employ this? But it potentially saves countless hours and money to the business to be able to to automate that process, and obviously, you know, reduces a lot of risk in the same.
We'd love to take a step back and understand how you got to co-founding Ghost Security. What was the career progression lead up?
Yeah, you know, my story, as many cybersecurity entrepreneurs' stories, are probably not too unique. I was a computer hacker as a kid. I want to say a good one. It was just a hobby of mine in the late 90s, early 2000s. It was something that was just kind of like a personal interest that I kind of rabbit holed down starting in high school. And, you know, some people have the traditional path. I went to college and got computer science. I was more of the college dropout hacker kid. And was lucky enough to create some software early in my career. I was working for a cybersecurity startup out of Silicon Valley, and I wrote a piece of cybersecurity software I thought would be interesting. And it turns out that hundreds of you know, blue chip organizations adopted and started using that software all over the world. And that's what really kind of gave me the idea that, hey, maybe I should turn this into a business. And I used that list of customers of my open source software to raise my first round. It was, I was backed by Google Ventures very, very early in that fund's lifespan. I think I was maybe the third or fourth investment around the time. I think Uber was the big one in the early days of Uber. So that was in 2013. That's when I started my journey as a entrepreneur and CEO. And I'm on my third company now, third cybersecurity company with Ghost. So it's been an incredible journey, a lot of lessons learned. You know, been very fortunate.
That's fantastic. May I ask, how did things turn out with the previous two companies?
Yeah, great. So the first company is called Anomaly. It's based in Redwood City, California. When Google invested, I was living in New York City at the time, and I had been supporting a lot of the big financials in New York with some cybersecurity consulting and whatnot. And I had no interest in leaving New York City. I had imagined myself in a downtown kind of Soho brick loft office for my startup, and just loved New York and New York City. Of course, I was young, and everybody who's young loves New York City. And they said, look, you know, you want this investment, you have to move to the Bay Area. And they ensured me that things would go off like a rocket ship if I did. And I said, you know, what do I have to lose? So I packed up what little I had in my small Manhattan apartment and moved to the West Coast. And they were right. It did. It took off like a rocket ship. Moving there was the right move. I spent, you know, a decade in Silicon Valley, built Anomaly in Redwood City. I ultimately, around Series B, brought in a kind of more senior pro CEO and hired him as it was my first company. And, you know, shortly after that, maybe like 6 months, I realized that, you know, I wasn't happy anymore not being the boss. So I left that company that I founded, which was a very difficult thing to do, but ultimately it was the right thing to do. And the company's flourished and done really well. I'm really proud of that company. And then my second company, I founded JASK. We started in downtown San Francisco, moved the headquarters when I moved to Austin, Texas in 2018. Great timing to move to Austin. And we exited, sold that business to a pre-IPO tech company called Sumo Logic. We did a all stock or mostly stock merger. And then very shortly after, we went through the IPO process on the NASDAQ. So that was a lot of fun, a cool experience to go through. And so that was a win as well. So fortunate enough to have two big wins on my track record, and now we're working on Ghost, and still early in Ghost story, but I think I'm more excited about the potential of Ghost Talk about a perfect time. It's both one of the hardest times right now to build a startup, in my opinion. And we can talk a little bit about that. But it's also, one of the most exciting times because you have this like incredible innovation that's just starting to blossom in AI. And I think companies that are early in taking advantage of that opportunity have huge potential.
Why do you think it's never been more challenging to get a company off the ground?
Yeah, I think it's probably related to macroeconomic climate coming out of zero interest rate policy where cash was flowing. And now we're in an environment where there's this kind of pressure where the IPO markets are kind of dead right now. Investors are in a holding pattern. A lot of the VC communities are making deals, but it's a much smaller number of deals. And, they even joke amongst themselves that there's like this select few that are the anointed ones that get these big deals and valuations. And everybody else, it's really a spreadsheet exercise of, okay, you hit, 1.5 million ARR, you're allowed to have a Series A now. And that wasn't the case before. It was just good vision, good teams. And, they were taking risks and making bets. And, the environment we're in now, getting deals are a lot harder because that downward pressure. And I think those high interest rates and kind of market volatility has put pressure on public companies, which in tune has put pressure on their budgets for investment in software. And that's even, includes cybersecurity, of course. It's just really hard, where you would call a friendly customer, maybe you did business with in the past, say, hey, I'd love to get in and show you what innovation we're working on. And they're like, well, maybe not this year, Greg. times are tough. I just had to cut a bunch of my team members. I don't have the resources. So we're hearing these types of messages consistently throughout the market. And I talk to other founders right now that are in the early stage talking Series C to Series B. And it's kind of the similar pain. And then, you talk to VCs and they're doing a lot of bridge rounds right now for their companies. So I think zooming out, the climate for building a startup right now, I believe, is the hardest I've seen in my career as a founder. Remember I got started around 2013. So we're talking, going on almost 15 years of being a founder. It's just harder now. But it's not impossible. If you have a very good product and you have a simple way to communicate that value and good execution, you can punch through the noise. But it requires a lot of focus. It requires a lot of responsibility, I think, to manage your burn and make sure that you can weather the storm until you find product market fit. You can prove to those investors that you have the repeatable success stories with your customers. So it's all possible. It's just very hard.
Yeah. I'm curious. So, with the previous two companies, were you thinking about profitability or was the mindset, hey, money's cheap, let me just grow top line and everything will work out for the best?
Yeah, more of the latter, right? That was the play. Money was cheap. You focused on top line and it was all growth. There was no consideration on cost of customer acquisition. It was just AR, new ARR was the only measurement. And eventually you get to a certain point, obviously churn and making sure those metrics were good in terms of like gross and net retention. But other than that, companies are only measured on how fast they could grow new ARR and maintain those customers over time. And that's not the case anymore. Now, investors are really digging in deeper and wanting to know about the margin story. They're wanting to know about, net dollar retention. They're wanting to know, how much does it cost for you to acquire a customer? Because am I dumping, tens of millions of dollars in this business so you can go buy a bunch of customers with these expensive sales reps and their relationships, knowing that we're going to hit a plateau with that model eventually. When they we run through those Rolodexes, you know, what are we going to do? The business has got a flat line. And, you know, we've all seen that movie play out, especially companies that, you know, receive the benefit of 2020, 2021 valuations where, you know, wacky stuff was happening and huge cash injections. So now I think there's this kind of more sobering kind of back to reality, like what makes a good business, and figuring out how to do things efficiently, how to do things at scale. Really, it causes you to kind of get back to basics and less experimentation and just kind of focus execution on what works and kind of meaningful incremental steps. And then once you can prove that out, I think more of these early stage investors get comfortable with, you know, pouring more money and starting to scale that model and figuring out, okay, how do we go big now? You know, going big from the get-go, you see a lot less of that nowadays. Yep. Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. I think there's another consequence to what you just described, and that is that founders could defer the decision to accept venture dollars because they've been forced to look at their business through a profitability lens. And so I'm curious, you know, you've had a track record of, sounds like, you know, big success having accepted venture dollars. Mm-hmm. Have you started to, given the environment, have you started to reconsider diluting yourself and saying, you know, well, I'm maybe I'm going to run with this a little bit longer before I do a round, if I do one.
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been fortunate enough to be able to give back and invest in and advise in other startups over the last handful of years. And, you know, especially with first-time founders, I always get the question, you know, do I bootstrap? Do I raise money? Look, I'm of the use someone else's money mindset. Don't use your own hard-earned money. What we're doing is high risk enough. What you're able to put in your bank account, you need to save and protect for your family. If you have something really good, you know, go find investors that have a little bit bigger risk appetite. And so I definitely think VC is a strong way to go. But you're asking a really good question. When does it make sense to, you know, take back some of that control? And maybe it doesn't make sense to do a Series A or a Series B round. Some companies are just not destined to be billion-dollar companies or IPO candidates. And I think that, you know, founders need to understand the incentive models of VCs and how that works. And then they can kind of start mm-hmm. to, you know, think on their own and realize, okay, if VCs are, you know, they're measured by the metrics of their fund, and the fund metrics can get better two ways. One is that there's an outcome, an exit, right? And this is the one that everybody knows about, right? I get acquired for 10x or 100x. That's a big win for my team and the founders and the investors. But what I think a lot of folks don't really understand the nuances is on deal markups. And if another round is raised at a higher valuation, that fund also gets marked up, and the LPs in that venture fund, you know, see an increase in value. So the investors are incentivized, and their bonuses are tied to, you know, increasing value of that fund. So that's going to happen either from an exit or from a new investment at a higher valuation, right? So in a way, it's easier to raise money than it is to sell a company, right? Selling a company is very, very hard, right? That's a very elite group of people that get into that circle, because you have to go through a lot to have a good outcome, right? And let's hope that all founders make it there. So knowing those two things and how VCs are incentivized, you can understand that, okay, well, what incentivizes me? Do I want to make sure that everybody on the cap table, even the common investors, my first engineer that came in, my first sales guy, my first marketing individual, do I want to make sure that they win big as well? And that's when you start questioning, okay, how big is this business really going to be? What is my TAM? How far do we want to take this? Are we in for the sprint, the half marathon, or the marathon, or the triathlon, right? And, you know, a good founder will be, you know, up for any of those things. But if you ask yourself honestly, you're probably able to understand your business and the market dynamics to say, you know what, this is probably a strategic asset that maybe another tech company like a Microsoft or a Cisco would want to acquire. It's probably the sweet spot for them because, you know, they don't want to pay up on big valuations either. Is post Series A, maybe Series B. I think this could be maybe like a 300 to 500 million exit if we maximize, and start thinking about, you know, what does that look like for you and your team after Series A, after Series B. You start every round, you know, you're taking probably between, you know, 20% and 30% dilution to the whole cap table. So that compounds pretty quickly. So you gotta ask, you gotta start asking yourself these questions and thinking these through, because, you know, I meet a lot of entrepreneurs that have built great businesses, 100 million ARR businesses, but they've been at it for 10 years and they've taken so many rounds and diluted themselves so many times that they would have probably had the same outcome if they just sold the business after year two.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great point. I don't know how, you know, we're a bit unique in so much as we're providing fractional CFO services to our clients. So we're having those conversations. But I would tell you, in the normal course, just interacting with founders, they know that there's this concept of an exit. I'd like to monetize this business, but they don't necessarily understand what the path looks like.
Yeah.
From A to Z. And yeah, I mean, answering questions like, well, what's the consequence of accepting outside dollars? Because there are. Good news is that, you know, we see more instances of venture debt popping up. You know, so given the bigger focus on profitability and cash flow, you know, we're seeing a proliferation of venture debt lenders. And, you know, it's just more optionality for a founder to hold on to more of the company, or at least, you know, deferring the decision to bring on, you know, equity partners. I'm curious, and obviously I don't want you to share, you know, anything confidential, but have you raised any outside equity for Go Security yet?
Outside equity, you mean venture capital?
Yes.
Yeah, we've raised 18 million so far, and you know, I would say a healthy amount, and you know, great firms, you know, Silicon Valley based firms. I've had a relationship with most of them and worked with them for some time, and you know, I think that in this market, thankfully, we did go that route early on, and we did raise a little bit larger round to give us the breathing room to figure things out. But it's easier. The one thing that's easier as a multi-time founder is getting that big sure. first investment. Everything else I'm finding is still very hard. I thought it would be easier, but definitely. You know, just new challenges in the market you have to work through. The way that people buy software nowadays has changed. Buyer psychology, COVID, I think all of it has played a factor. And you know, flying to New York and taking someone out to dinner or steak dinner and having wine with your sales rep and your customer, that model is kind of outdated now. So how do you build relationships? How do you, you know, earn trust with your clients? You know, there's just new things that you have to do. You have to be out there educating and creating content and being a thought leader in your space and creating an environment where customers come to you. And that's a new motion. That wasn't the case, you know, 5-10 years ago, where you could just, you know, have a team of college kids cold calling customers, pitching their ideas. You know, that model unfortunately doesn't work anymore.
So. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think one of the benefits of the internet and now how AI is becoming more ubiquitous is that there's a lot of transparency. It's a lot easier to find information. And so you're right. I've seen the same thing, is that the way buyers make decisions has changed.
100%.
It's like, there was a time where someone in marketing will tell you, write a blog post
Yeah.
to establish your credibility. And I was like, well, you have to appreciate someone has, availability to ChatGPT. They can get answers to the majority of their questions. I think the question now becomes more around execution. Give me insights into why what you've built is gonna best serve me. And then you're right. I think relationships are really important. I think they're the, that's the it's kind of like the existential overarching theme that I see. It's like, let me know that you understand my business and you care about me. Obviously, it becomes challenging to do that at scale, like your reference of exhausting the Rolodex. And so, again, without sharing any trade secrets, any insights that you've accumulated in the last couple of years that you're finding it's doing the trick in terms of reach? Because you still got to initiate those conversations as your top line grows.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that being a thought leader, standing out, leading with authenticity, I think is working right now in this market. I would say that the human element still matters very, very much. Relationships matter very, very much. And whether it's virtual, I prefer in person. I think that's a more powerful way to build relationships, but it's harder to get people in person now. So, we've kind of come up with these more kind of regional plans where, okay, we'll go to one city. Maybe we'll partner with another partner firm that can help split the costs, and we'll go to Chicago. We'll go to Phoenix. We'll go to Dallas. We'll go to New York and spend a day. And instead of focus on wining and dining, maybe you have a lunch, but you have some kind of guest speaker and it's educational, and you're kind of building a community, educating and building relationships all at the same time. So it's a little bit of a different model now that I find is working, but getting people together still, I think, and having that human element to your business is still, incredibly important and fundamental. The idea that we're going to automate the sales process with, AI sending emails and LinkedIn messages and automatically converting to self-service customers, I don't see it. And I think that's kind of a road to failure. And at least in kind of B2B enterprise, trust is a really important factor. And sure, they're going to do their own research about your company, your solution, your technology, just like I would when I'm wanting to buy the next iPhone. I'm not going to walk in the Apple store and say, "Hey, will you help me out and tell me about the new iPhone?" No, I know already what I want when I walk in there. I just give them my order, right? And so fundamentally, you're right. The way people buy things has changed, but the kind of need for trust and wanting to do business with people that you like, right, and you trust, that doesn't go away. So how do you kind of fuse those models together in this new market and figure out, okay, how do I create trust and relationships and be likable, which I think comes from authenticity, right? So where I wear a hat in my meetings on Zoom with customers, maybe some find it disrespectful, but they get the real Greg. And I think a lot of our customers just really appreciate that. So we try to lean into it and be ourselves and stick to our passions about cybersecurity. And we find a cohort of customers that resonate with that model. And ultimately wanna are more open to looking at the innovations that you build. And those are the kind of customers that we seek.
It's interesting. A question that I've asked over the podcast has been how deliberate you are with culture. And I'm thinking about asking you this question. You're unique amongst podcast guests in that you've had a lot of prior success, which I have to imagine influences how you think about building a team and your business today. But any Any key thoughts that you have to founders listening about, you know, it's like, is this something that just happens organically? Or are you noticing, you know what, I'm going to be very deliberate about doing the following things to make sure that I'm satisfied we've got a company that reflects my values?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Culture is so important, especially, you know, if you're an early stage company, you want your, you know, it's not family that you're building. It is a job. It is a business. But, you know, it can sometimes feel like that because you're a small team and you're working on something really hard and there's so much trust required that, you know, you get really close to your tribe that you build. So I think, you know, transparency and openness about the business. Sometimes, you know, it's uncomfortable to share things like total outstanding shares. Do we share this information? Well, nowadays, guess what? They're going to ask for that. And it's wrong not to share it. So things have changed a lot in the level of transparency that founders have with their team. And I think for the better. And I think you got to embrace that change and figure out how to make that journey where you create a culture where there's those inherent trusts and the team's going to go through the roller coaster ride with you. They're, you know, you let them know about the ups, you let them know about the downs. And if you do that, I believe you create a culture where people are willing to run through walls with you or walk lava, whichever analogy you prefer. The other thing is, you know, try to find startup people. And this is something that, you know, I've learned mostly from the hard way. But, you know, if you work with somebody at a big company in the past and they were a top performer, they may very well be your lowest performer in a startup because it takes a complete different DNA and skill set to be successful as an early individual contributor or any role in a startup in kind of the first kind of 0 to 5 million ARR of the journey. It takes an extreme level of adaptability. And I think that's the one thing that we tend to try to identify is adaptability, like how open and are you with change? How, you know, ask questions like, okay, you know, if you're interviewing an account executive in an early stage company, like you have no tools or documentation, how do you build pipeline from scratch? You know, like ask some of these challenging questions and listen to how they think and their creativeness. And if they're telling you a story of how they've done this in the past and what you're looking for is someone that, you know, is able to think on their own and be creative and experiment and is not going to need a lot of handholding, system support processes, because you don't get any of those in a startup. It's your job to figure that out and build it. And hopefully you have that down the road. But in the beginning, you need teams that can just dig in and start executing. And the other thing is you want to screen out Lone Rangers. Lone Rangers are individuals that thrive and execute and maybe even 10 times, you know, more output than a normal employee, whether we're talking about an engineer or someone else, but they don't work good with a team. They want to work in their isolated environment and not work with others. Lone Rangers can be very, very exciting in the early days of a startup because of the high output, but they can also be very dangerous and create a huge problem for the business down the road because they're unwilling to share that information and they're unwilling to collaborate with the team, and it can create real bottlenecks. So I would say, you know, finding highly adaptable startup ready individuals and avoiding Lone Rangers. That's my my best advice for early founders.
I love it. That's great. Yeah, we characterize it as smart and effective. You know, people who possess critical thinking skills and can, you know, take the initiative are great fits. But you're right. You know, calling out the fact that just because you succeed in a structured environment, you know, doesn't necessarily translate to an early stage environment, given the lack of structure, and
that's right.
Good with, you know, figuring things out on your own. Greg, close to wrapping up here. One of my favorite go-to questions is a retrospective, And I enjoy asking, if you had a chance to go back and have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
Great question. I would say you are going to do amazing in life. Don't stress, just lean into who you are. And, you know, maybe that would have saved me some tears and sleepless nights getting through, trying to get through college and keep my parents happy. Right. But ultimately it all ended up great. And, you know, by, I think most measures have been a success. And, you know, I think that, you know, being a young 20-year-old or a teenager worried about, you know, getting into the right school or getting a high score on their SATs or, you know, getting a scholarship for baseball or what have you, it's just it's so much stress at that age. And, you know, as an adult, I look back and I'm like, you know, some of it is good, right? It pushes you to be better. But some of it is just really unnecessary. And now as a father of two boys, I'm always trying to ask myself, like, you know, how do I find the right balance of, you know, teaching them resilience and, you know, life challenges, but, you know, not seeing them go through unnecessary amounts of stress that you know, affect their mental health. And I think that's the challenge, right?
Yeah. Everything's going to be okay. You know,
that's the message. Everything's going to be okay.
Do your best, forget the rest. Greg, more recent question. But if there's anyone in your network who's left an impression on you and you think that they'd have something worthwhile to share on the Innovators Investors podcast, who comes to mind?
Oh, so many excellent people that I would love to recommend to you. Let me think about that one. I don't know if I have someone right off the top of my head. But happy to send you a list of recommendations. I'm lucky enough to be surrounded by people that are much smarter than me, much more successful and handsome and all those great qualities. So, you know, you are defined by the company you keep. So that's,
Well, good stuff. On that note, for our listeners, take a look in the show notes, because we're going to publish Greg's recommendations, there, and make best efforts to see if we can't get at least one of them on the show. Greg, really appreciate your time. Thank you. If there are any of our listeners who'd like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Sure. I'm Greg C. Martin on LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn. That's the best place to find me. Ghost.security is our website. If you have software that you build in your company and you certainly need to protect it, we'd love to talk to you. So.
Fantastic. Good stuff. Well, you know how to get a hold of Greg, and it sounds like you now have, you know, a really good reason to do so. With that, again, Greg Martin, CEO, co-founder of Ghost Security. Greg, again, appreciate your time. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. Take care.
Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor who would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. If you'd like to know more, go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is @finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.